You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Squeaky Curd, a food show coming to you from CGLO, where we examine our relationship with food here in Montreal. I'm your host, Gwen Rowley, and I am not a food expert. I just like to eat. Today, we're going to be talking about Montreal's Chinatown. Chinatown has been making the news a lot lately after a buy-up of property and the possibility of redevelopment, which has led to a campaign to grant the neighborhood historic landmark status. The fear for many is that the historic buildings bought up between De La Gauchetière, St. Urban and Côté Streets, and Vigée Avenue will lose much of their inherited significance if the properties were redeveloped without thought for the neighborhood's history. The focal point for this episode won't necessarily be food. We'll definitely be looking at the importance food has for a neighborhood like Chinatown and how it contributes to remembrance and community. In looking at these things, we'll touch on the struggles Chinatown has faced in the past and more recently with the rise in anti-Asian racism, as well as taking a look at its preservation and growth into the future. To start off, we're going to look at a little history to give us some context. I talked to Charles Hugh, who is a PhD candidate at McGill and the manager of internal operations at the Chinatown Working Group, which was established to revitalize Chinatown.
Yeah, my name is Charles Hugh. My position, I am a PhD student at McGill University in the Redpath Museum and Department of Biology. My pronouns are he, him.
Charles and I talked about the history of immigration from China to Canada during the 19th century. Most people who immigrated from China arrived on the West Coast and began working in the much-needed hard labor jobs for an industrializing country.
So you've had, it was like something like 15,000 Chinese railroad workers, late 1800s, building the railroad, the Canadian Pacific Railway. And the same year that railway was finished, the Canadian government enacted the Chinese head tax. So basically they said, all right, you're done, like you finished what we wanted you to come here to do, but we don't want you to settle down and be part of the country and benefit from the railroad that you just built.
While xenophobia was present everywhere, it felt higher on the West Coast as a series of hateful acts and riots targeting Asian immigrants sprung up in Vancouver and other places on the West Coast of Canada and the United States at the turn of the 20th century. This caused many immigrants to move east and settle in places across Canada like Montreal. The new arrivals gathered together in a neighborhood with Jewish and Scottish enclaves between what is now downtown and Old Port, and would become Montreal's Chinatown. Here's Charles talking a little bit more about the unique history of the Chinatown in Montreal.
There used to be a Chinatown in Quebec City that apparently disappeared in the early 2000s. Mm. And so Montreal Chinatown is now the last Chinatown in Quebec, and it is the only French-speaking Chinatown in North America. And so part of the reason why we're arguing that Chinatown should be designated as a heritage site is because it is an integral part of Quebec history, of Montreal history, of the history of immigration, of the history of Chinese Canadians, of Chinese Quebecers. All of these things that you can't find literally anywhere else.
The location of Montreal's Chinatown was established in part because many of the people who moved to Montreal were still part of the railroad industry. But as the Chinese immigrant community continued to grow, many people in the neighborhood began to establish laundry businesses. This was soon followed by the establishment of many Chinese restaurants. I also talked to Fei Sun from the Concordia Student Union for this story.
My name is Fei Sun, and I will be the incoming sustainability coordinator at the CSU. I'm also a member of the BIPOC committee, and my preferred pronouns are she, they.
Faye spoke to me about Concordia's relationship with Chinatown and the campaign to combat anti-Asian racism on campus, which we'll be looking at a little later in the episode. But here's what she had to say about what food means to Chinatown.
Well, speaking as a Chinese Canadian, for me, it's not just the food, it's like a little piece of home. And one of the first business ventures for Asian Canadians and Asian Americans were restaurants when they first came to North America. And like colloquially, we have the word chow, let's get some chow. That's like from basically like, you know, them referring to Chinese food because they were so plentiful around settler times when people were working in mines, when people were just settling here. And some of like the most accessible food was Chinese food for all of these workers. And I think a lot of Chinatowns developed from, you know, supporting the different populations that came here based on the food that they can provide. And also for me as a Chinese Canadian, it's just, it's something that's important to me to have somewhere I can go that I feel somewhat welcome and where I can find food that makes me feel like I'm at home. And I think that's the case for a lot of immigrants. And like, you might not have your language anymore, you might not have all these other things, but at least you have your food. And that's one way you can connect to your culture. And having a Chinatown is so important because there are also other services that Chinatowns provide aside from food.
I also spoke with Edmund Koo, one of the co-owners of the family-run Chinatown institution, Dobie and Andy.
Well, our restaurant is Dobie and Andy, and I'm one of the co-owners. My name's Edmund Koo.
Edmund and I talked about the history of his family's business and how it has had to move around and adapt while still upholding one of Chinatown's longest traditions. Really delicious food for what Edmund would say is a ridiculously low price.
Well, basically, it was my father and my mother that started the restaurant. We're like three brothers. And basically my father worked at an older restaurant. I'm not sure if you would know it. It's called Kenny Wong. Mm-hmm. And when my younger brother was born, Eric, in 1982, he opened a restaurant, Dobie and Andy. At first it wasn't called Dobie and Andy. It was called Feng Lam. And a lot of the older Chinese people, they still call it Feng Lam. Mm-hmm. So it started out as just like a regular type Chinese restaurant, like sit down style. And then later on, like my dad started with the barbecue, like what we're more famous for now. And the Chinese barbecue. And then fortunately he started the trend where he was selling very cheap ducks. So he was selling like $7 a duck, and then like basically making no money off of it, but just bringing people in. And that actually was at the older location. It was at the 1071 Saint-Laurent. And actually the older location was only my older brother, Edward, that had worked at the older location. We moved to the current location on 1071 Saint-Urban in 1994. Where we started doing more fondue or Chinese fondue, like all you can eat, which my dad also sold at a ridiculous price. It was, I believe it was $6.50 all you can eat Chinese fondue, which is a little crazy. Yeah, so it was 1995, 1996, was me and my younger brother were starting to work there as well, making stuff and so like that. And it's, dates aren't very straight. Then we had an ice storm, I think in 1998. And pretty much that's what stopped, we stopped doing the fondue then, and we're doing what we're doing now, Hong Kong style diner with the barbecue on the side. And basically the partners right now, it's my older brother, Edward, my younger brother, Eric. And also we brought in a talented chef that worked at a couple other places, Webster Galman.
Aside from his own restaurant, Edmund and I talked about the importance of having a place like Chinatown where there is a high concentration of Chinese restaurants.
Well, before, as opposed to now, if you wanted to go dim sum, 90% or maybe like 95% of those types of restaurants were in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. It's a big thing for like most people, and like especially for my family, like we had to go, but we like to go anyway too. Like we went like at least once a week, like went to Furama back then and the other ones too.
Many of the restaurants in Chinatown are family owned, like Dobie and Andy, and some have been in these families for multiple generations. Having a business for that long means they've been able to perfect their recipes over those generations. Here's Charles talking a little bit more about the inherited food culture of Montreal's Chinatown.
It is amazing watching them work in the back. It's like almost a work of art. There are like recipes that are like 100 years old. Sauces that, you know, they don't buy canned sauces. They make sauces from scratch. And like the techniques, right, that like you don't learn in school mm-hmm. that are like passed down. So there is definitely that link. Another Chinatown working group member, Bethany, she I think is like a fourth generation Chinese Canadian, and her great grandfather was a servant, I believe, in Westmount, and she posted like a scan of a like super old school Chinese recipe written in like traditional font up and down mm-hmm. that he made for like his employers back in the 1800s in Westmount. There's like definitely that connection of like, you know, these recipes you find in Chinatown, you really can't find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these recipes are fusion, right? They don't even exist in China. And so that kind of unique Chinese Canadian, Chinese American identity is something worth preserving, not just as a link to China, but of a uniqueness of itself that you can't find anywhere else.
Food is, of course, just a part of a cultural heritage which exists in Chinatown. The history of Montreal's Chinatown is a combination of people, food, culture, festivals, architecture, and so many other things that don't exist anywhere else in the city or in the world.
At least within, there's a guy who is now he works for the Ontario government in education, and he's like 2 years from retirement. And he was actually born in Chinatown. For a lot of these people, this person I mentioned, like his heritage only goes back that far, right? He has very little connection with China. His like ancestral home is basically Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And so there's that part of it, this intangible heritage that is pretty much gone once you lose it. You can't rebuild that sort of stuff. And the value of these sorts of places have been demonstrated to be really, really high. Like even in China now, I can tell you that there is more and more value placed on history and heritage.
When we come back from the break, we will be looking more at efforts to preserve Montreal's Chinatown in the face of rising anti-Asian racism and under the threat of redevelopment in the neighborhood. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Today, we're looking at the preservation of Montreal's Chinatown. Before the break, we discussed the establishment of the Chinatown in Montreal and the significance food has had in the neighborhood. In this segment, we'll of course be looking more at the importance of food in Chinatown as the neighborhood has changed and how it has experienced a more recent threat of rising anti-Asian racism. Just as a warning at the top, this segment does include discussions of racially motivated threats, harassment, and vandalism. One of these stories will include curses, which are bleeped out. To learn more about the recent changes in Montreal's Chinatown, I talked to Queenie C., whose family owns the bookstore Teen Teen Magazine on Clark Street.
My name is Juan Queenie C., and my pronouns are she, her.
Here's Queenie talking about her family's business.
Yes. So my parents own a shop called Teen Teen Magazine. It's actually been in Chinatown for 30 plus years. The location used to be in a basement underneath a restaurant, but my parents took over officially 8 years ago. So we spent 1 year in that basement location, and then we spent 5 years, I don't know if you're familiar, the Swatow Plaza. Mm-hmm. And then we also, now it's going to be 2 years now that we're at Ruby Rouge, which is our latest, newest location. So we're on the ground floor. You could always swing by, say hi to my dad, bring him a milk tea, and he'll chat with you.
One of the things Queenie brought up that she has seen as a positive change in Chinatown is an improved friendliness to people coming to Chinatown by car. Many people come to the neighborhood from off the island, and she said there's more places to park now, and in the winter, the city is doing a better job of clearing snow from the narrow streets so people still have access to these businesses. Queenie says she comes to Chinatown a lot to visit her parents' store, but she also comes to eat.
I feel like, you know what, Chinatown is associated by the Chinese culture, but for me, like, food just gathers people around, right? So when I think of Chinatown, I think of my favorite snack places. I think of my favorite spot to grab milk tea from my parents because they have their favorites, you know? I think about, like, you know, we have this period where it's called high tea. Mm-hmm. So, like, you get these amazing lunch menus for, like, less than $10, and you get a drink, a meal, and a little snack on the side, and people are not aware of that. Like, they don't know how to order it, or they don't know that it's only available from, like, 1 to 3 p.m. kind of thing. So whenever I talk about Chinatown and I tell my friends about it, I was like, oh, you have to stop at this place to eat. You got to go there to try this new thing. You need to order this dish. And so it's like, sometimes I would tell my friends, like, okay, if you swing by, go there, buy this, go there, buy that. And then come back and thank me later. Yeah. There are quite a few restaurants that I grew up always just going to naturally. And, like, it's crazy. Like, they're still there, which I'm so happy about. But I feel like more people need to know that, like, yes, it's a hole in the wall, but it's still delicious. That's why it's still here.
The positive changes that Queenie and I talked about have been accompanied with some negative ones as well. While the xenophobia Asian Canadians experienced in the 19th and 20th centuries never disappeared completely, the past year and a half has seen a rise in anti-Asian racism, which has mainly been catalyzed by a fear that incorrectly connects Asian people with the spread of COVID-19 during the coronavirus pandemic.
So although I didn't witness with my own eyes someone vandalizing, I saw the aftermath. So when I would visit and pick up my dad, for example, from the shop, I would see that, like, some glasses were broken into, people would leave graffitis on, and some statues in Chinatown were actually broken. So, like, it's just heartbreaking to witness that people, it's like, oh, you had time to do that? And I guess because of the rise of the pandemic, and then, you know, unfortunately, like, certain figures in the government assigning, you know, the COVID-19 virus as, like, a Kung flu or Chinese virus, like, that had a really negative effect for the community, and also by association with Chinatown.
Anti-Asian racism didn't just appear out of nowhere because there was an association with Asian people and COVID. This history of xenophobia in Canada and the United States has always been there. There have just been moments where fear has been stoked and created waves of greater amounts of discrimination. For example, in the early 20th century, there was a large wave of anti-Asian sentiment as more immigrants arrived and white laborers were worried this would mean they would lose their jobs to the newcomers. Charles explained how the government reacted to this.
In the 1930s, I believe, 1920s or 1930s, Canada enacted the Chinese Exclusion Act, which basically just, like, put a blanket immigration ban. And along with the US, that's, like, one of the, like, I think it is the only immigration law to specifically target a single ethnicity. So there's always been this sort of, like, yellow peril, this fear of Asian people specifically as the perpetual foreigner, as something so foreign that they lack the ability to integrate, to learn the language, the culture, the values.
Charles and I also discussed how even before, and probably after, COVID, he already felt like there was a rising anti-Asian sentiment in the West because of a perceived increased threat coming from China as it begins to match the U.S. in business, science, and even military strength. So, before COVID, there was still, of course, xenophobia and anti-Asian racism that was ready to be stoked by the flame of the pandemic. I talked to Edmund about this a little bit, and he said there were definitely benign incidents at his restaurant and in their building leading up to the coronavirus last year.
Yeah, no, like, we're very fortunate that we haven't seen or, like, personally much anti-Asian racism. Like, same thing as before, even, like, before COVID, like, sometimes you'll get, like, stupid kids calling, like, saying ridiculousness, like, do you sell dog or do you sell bat or something like that. I don't think that's really, like, a COVID thing, because it happened before, too. I'm not sure if that's any different. Like, well, our particular mall, like, because we're in the commercial condo, broken into, I don't remember if it was how many months ago, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. Like, we didn't get broken into, but I think 5-6 other stores got broken into. And for no real reason, like I don't know if you call it vandalism or they're trying to steal anything. Cause like in reality, today's businesses, there's not much money to steal. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what was the real point of doing that, or if they're just like trying to vandalize. And they're vandalized, I believe, like the Buddhist temples, and then they defaced one of the lions in the entry of Chinatown. But in the beginning, also, well, I don't like, as you can't really tell if COVID actually affected it, but in the beginning, everybody was affected, all restaurants were affected, but we seem to have been affected a little bit earlier than other people. Like, unfortunately, I was actually traveling in Asia when the COVID started. Mm. So when I came back around like beginning of February last year, like just before Chinese New Year, and our business started going down. I was like down to like maybe 25-30% of sales, and that affected us.
Charles also talked to me about one personal experience that caused him to want to get more involved with anti-Asian racism activism in Montreal.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, I've experienced anti-Asian racism, so it got a lot of news coverage because it was the same person who attacked a Asian woman, Rebecca, on the metro, and she took a TikTok, a video of it that got uploaded to TikTok and went viral, and it was very, very striking, upsetting to see just how aggressive he was. He formed a gun with his hand and pretended to shoot her in the face, and swore at her, and there was a bunch of people sitting next to her who didn't say anything or do anything, and I think that sparked a lot of outrage and reflection by people of, you know, what would I do if I was in that situation. And a lot of people, I think, have tried to educate themselves about things like bystander training. So yeah, for me, it was about like an hour before that incident on the metro. My girlfriend and I were getting sushi in the village, and he yelled like "China, Japan" at me. So both her and I, we both forwarded the case to the Montreal police, which then got forwarded to the hate crimes unit, and they decided not to pursue my case, prosecute my case, because it doesn't technically count as a hate crime.
These stories are not new, and they are not infrequent. But Queenie talked about how the specific pattern she's witnessed recently has made her want to get more involved with standing up and protecting the Asian community.
Honestly, in the past, like I've experienced xenophobia already in the past, and I just kind of just let it go. And I didn't realize how much it had affected me or how much I had normalized it over the years growing up, which is why the rise of it all made it so significant. Like it kind of like, how would you say, like it woke you, you know, like it made you realize like, wait, I let that happen so many times because I always figured like, oh, we were told to just, you know, keep our heads down and it's like, it'll pass and we'll be fine. You know, just focus on your work or focus on something else. Don't start a fight. But now it's like people are realizing, especially like my generation, we're being like, oh no, we have to protect our seniors because they're fragile. They can't speak up for themselves. So we need to let them know, like, this is not okay. And if you witness it, you have to speak up. And if you can't do anything at the moment, at least, you know, delegate it to someone else or ask for help.
Faye also knew the woman who was harassed in the metro and said that having something that hateful happen to someone they knew changed how they looked at the recent trend of hatred towards Asian people.
It's just very jarring to find out that someone so close to you had experienced something like that because, you know, until it actually happens to someone close to you and, you know, personally to you, it's sort of still it seems like a distant thing, but, you know, it's still in the back of your mind. And just looking at the statistics too, you know that the instances have been rising, and given all the increased reports about it, it's definitely not a coincidence that this is happening. And of course, racism has existed before COVID, but I think that COVID definitely exacerbated the situation and people needed someone to blame. So they chose Asians to blame. And the fact of the matter is there are so many different factors that lead to a pandemic that, you know, scientifically, you just can't do that. But, you know, because of the social climate, this is what happens.
Faye's position at the CSU also meant we were able to talk about what combating anti-Asian racism on campus has looked like at Concordia. Here's what she had to say.
Generally, I find that, of course, the Asian students at Concordia were the most concerned. We have gotten requests from Asian communities on campus about what we can do to try and combat anti-Asian racism. And one of the main concerns is that they don't feel safe in Montreal because of all the instances of violence that have occurred. And unfortunately, the school itself had not released any kind of statement or anything. CSU has actually released a statement like near around March about how, you know, people were claiming that the pandemic was the fault of Chinese people and how the virus is, you know, race-based. And I was really happy to see that from the CSU, although we didn't see anything from the school about it. And it was only recently that they had released a series of videos on their website about, you know, racism in general, and maybe one video about anti-Asian racism. And it's been very slow for the school itself to do anything about it. And the CSU also, we're trying to release a bunch of events and support systems for the students because of all of the input that we received.
The CSU just wrapped up a long list of events that included lectures and writing workshops this week for Asian Heritage Month, but there are still things they're trying to do to support Asian and other BIPOC students. Faye mentioned the need for higher security around campus, especially for new students who might not know the city very well as the increased mental health resources. Security, mental health resources, and of course, vocal advocacy in opposition to anti-Asian racism are ways to make real change. But Faye said one of the simplest things people can do is start to talk about the problem.
You can, you know, spread information, you can connect with people to get them involved in protests and things, get your friends who aren't Asian involved, because if they want to be allies, then that's also something that they should take seriously. And and for Asian communities, it's really important to also just acknowledge that there is a problem. And, you know, that's one of the main barriers, is often people don't want to acknowledge that there is a problem that needs to be solved. They're just like, well, life is supposed to be hard anyway, so I better suck it up and deal with it, right? And, you know, it's easier sometimes to do that, to sort of just ignore it, but nothing will change if we keep doing that. So yeah, it's really important to just acknowledge that, you know, there's something that needs to be changed.
One of the things Faye and I also discussed was the idea of Chinatown 2, a collection of Asian culture and restaurants close to Concordia's downtown campus. Even though it's different than the Chinatown, which is closer to Old Port, Faye said that there were benefits to having both.
It's nice to have a place that where you feel welcome around campus too. And I find that, for me at least, it was so nice to actually see so many Chinese restaurants around where I'm studying. And if I need to go get something to eat, I can get something that's familiar to me as well while I'm on campus. And definitely they're not the same thing, of course. And I would say that Chinatown 2 is more catered to students, especially like millennials and, you know, the further generations. But I do find that a lot of students still like to go to Old Montreal and the Chinatown there, and mostly because of, you know, the cultural aspect of it. And it's really nice because there's so many really old buildings, and, you know, you can sort of explore the different areas, and there's so many things going on that, you know, like, it's great to have both. Mm-hmm.
While Chinatown 2 was on the rise about 20 years ago in response to the large number of international students in Montreal, the original Chinatown near Old Port had shrunk because of the large project which encroached on the traditional bounds of the neighborhood. Here's how Charles explained it.
Chinatown used to be a lot bigger than Montreal. Mm-hmm. And I think in like the sometime in the 90s or the 70s, I think, the city started expropriating huge swaths of Chinatown for development of things like the Palais de Congrès and the Guy Favreau for the government services, like Service Canada is in the Guy Favreau building, and the Palais de Congrès is like used by everybody for large convention stuff. So physically, Chinatown has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and it's been expropriated not for residential life, right? It's been mm-hmm. expropriated for like the complex de Jardin, like a giant shopping mall, and things that like people go to, not things that promote the growth of a community. So it's really prevented Chinatown from expanding and growing to its full potential.
More recently, a buy-up of property by Schiller and Kornbluth, a real estate company with a reputation for evictions and poor treatment of tenants in the name of property development, has reignited concerns about the preservation of Chinatown's history.
And this latest round of gentrification is attacking what is left of Chinatown. Which is you know, all that we have left, which is why people are super, super concerned. It's because you can only gentrify and take away so much until it disappears. So specifically, this particular block is really like the cornerstone of the history of Chinatown. So Chinatown is known as Chinatown today, but that area had been inhabited by the Jewish, the Irish, the Scottish, the French, all at some point. And the one building that there's a big building on that block that's now occupied by Wings Noodles. And they were the first ones to make fortune cookies in Canada. And the building itself, it was actually, I think, like a international, like French and British school back in the, I don't know, early 1900s or something. So there is a lot of history in Chinatown, and there's a lot of history in that block specifically. And what has happened is this shell company named 1000 Rue Saint-Urbain has began to buy up chunks and individual buildings within this block with the eventual aim of amalgamating all that land.
While many people are concerned about the plans for the block, it's important to point out that many people I talk to emphasize that there hasn't been any official plan made. And Schiller and Kornbluth have released statements saying they plan to respect the history of the neighborhood. Here's Edmund's thoughts on the property buy-up.
It's unfortunate, but the thing is, like, it's unfortunate because, like, that's pretty much, I don't remember if it's the oldest in Canada or oldest in North America, like, that company.
Mm-hmm.
I think they went through like at least four generations of people working there, and still the family working there. And it's awesome. Like, we actually buy our fresh noodles from there too. So that'd be sad, like, for them to leave. Like, they're super nice people too, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard. Like some of the people that actually say, like, oh, well, like, you should do something, but I'm like, well, dude, like, if I had their money, maybe I would, but, like, it's not that it's easy to say, and it's like, but, like, what can we really do? If they're, like, someone's willing to sell and this guy's willing to buy, if they're not, like, Asian, are you not going to sell to them? Like, and you can't tell, like, what they're going to do. Like, it might be good, it might be bad.
While there is still, of course, the hope that the new owners of these buildings would respect their history, the lessons of the past and the way Chinatown has already been affected by gentrification has made many want to act preemptively. Much of this work is being done through the Chinatown Working Group, an advocacy organization committed to the protection of the neighborhood. Here's Charles talking a little bit more about their mission.
So, yeah, the Chinatown Working Group has been around since March 2019. And it was an offshoot of PCQ, which is a group called the Progressive Chinese Quebecers. And basically, PCQ was concerned about gentrification, specifically within Chinatown, and not just gentrification, but in general, degradation and people leaving and lack of cultural spaces and cultural events. And so they formed a Chinatown Working Group. And since then, we have been actively collaborating with various other social activist organizations, as well as various levels of government, consulting efforts to revitalize Chinatown.
The Chinatown Working Group is a grassroots organization that uses the varied skills of its members, many of whom are featured in this show, to find solutions to some of the neighborhood problems. The work of the Chinatown Working Group was pivotal in the posting of the petition to designate Montreal's Chinatown a historic landmark, like the Old Port. Of course, they are not the only group advocating for the rights of Asian residents in Montreal, but Charles said what sets them apart is their relatively young organization. He also pointed out that their mission wasn't to hold Chinatown as a single moment in history, but rather to acknowledge the history of the neighborhood and find ways for it to evolve while being respectful of that history.
Every community changes and evolves, right, and grows. It's impossible for it to stay the same. And it hasn't stayed the same, right? We know this. The key is to try to figure out what kind of changes we want to see and how do we get there. So things like promoting these legacy businesses, these small businesses that have been there for a long time that add to the atmosphere of Chinatown, so that when you go to Chinatown, it still feels like Chinatown.
Here's one more thought from Queenie on why the preservation of Chinatown's history and energy should be a priority for the city.
We would have, you know, Canada's Day Parade or like Saint Jean-Baptiste Parade, and the finish line would always be around Saint Urban, Saint Catherine, mm-hmm. right? And that's near Chinatown. So then usually after a parade, it would end like around 2 to 3 p.m. kind of thing. So crowds would visit Chinatown after for tea time, you know? And then because, you know, it's like summertime, so summer festivities, and this is obviously pre-pandemic. So they would go to Chinatown, you know, try a few restaurants, get some snacks, hang out in the park. And then later on, they would just make their way towards Old Port because then the fireworks starts. Remember how like each week, like on Wednesdays and Saturdays, they would have like fireworks, right? So it's just like thinking about how it was kind of like the center, like the location point, the meeting point after like a big, you know, event. People would just gather in Chinatown, and we don't see that much of it anymore, unfortunately. And I think that that's why it's also one of the reasons why it's so important to protect Chinatown, because it's like, yes, it's also family, but we were present all this time, you know? So how can it be suddenly forgotten or, you know, just pushed aside?
When we come back from the break, we'll be looking at how Chinatown can move forward and evolve while holding on to its inherited significance. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Just a goodbye. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Today, we're looking at Montreal's Chinatown, and in the previous two segments, we looked at the history of Chinatown, how it's had to grapple with anti-Asian racism and gentrification, and we even talked a little bit about the significance of food in the neighborhood. In this segment, we'll be looking at the future of Montreal's Chinatown and how it can evolve and grow while still being respectful of its history. One new restaurant which is attempting to do this is the Japanese snack bar Fleury Cadeau, which opened in September last year. I talked to two of Fleury Cadeau's owners, Hideyuki Imazumi and David Schmidt, about their mission when opening their restaurant.
Hi, my name is Hideyuki. I'm an owner and operator at Fleury Cadeau.
Hi, my name is David Schmidt. I'm also an owner and operator at Fleury Cadeau. I also co-own another business in Chinatown called Le Mal Nécessaire.
Here's David talking about how their business got started.
So Fleury Cadeau is a restaurant in Chinatown with a Japanese kitchen, and we're a group of associates that were offered this space through the Chinatown Merchants Association. I co-own another business in Chinatown, so I've been in the Chinatown Merchants Association for quite some time, and kind of expressed my will to open a second business down here at some point, and was introduced to the owner of the building we're presently in. His name is Hiram Wong, and he lives upstairs from our restaurant and used to own and run the flower shop that we're presently inhabiting the space of. And before that, had a restaurant in this space as well. Bought the building in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. And he was retiring, so kind of offered us the space for rent and let us kind of you know, negotiate a lease with him and sign it with the good graces of being right under his living quarters and his apartment, you know, just above us. So yeah, that's it. It was a process of a couple months, kind of discussing with him and discussing the idea of the business that we were going to do, and as well, we kind of, you know, we're kind of sussing out in Chinatown with the different other tenants of restaurants and things of the sort that we knew. We were kind of discussing our project a little bit with them to see if it would be kind of accepted in the neighborhood and seen in a good light. And we were happily received by the other restaurant owners that we knew that were happy with the type of project we were doing and all of this. It was kind of a different approach to what's offered in Chinatown a little bit, and at the same time was kind of keeping the neighborhood feeling that is present right now in Chinatown and wants to be preserved.
Since they opened in September, right before Montreal went back into a stricter lockdown, David said they only got 8 nights of dine-in service before they had to pivot to takeout. Here's Hideyuki talking about the food they've been serving up for the takeout menu.
Yeah, so the type of food we are doing right now is it's Japanese food, and it's more, since I'm from Japan, I wanted to offer authentic Japanese food. I mean, I have nothing against North American Japanese food, but for me to contribute something to the city, I absorbed Japanese food made by a Japanese person. It's lacking a bit, so I found it for my interest to contribute in this city with our authentic palette of Japanese cuisine. And currently, as David has described, we are doing our takeouts, and we are doing our bento boxes. Inside is very varieties of many good fresh ingredients to we marinate and age and then grill and many goodies. And we do some Japanese curries and donburis, which is rice with meat on top, bowl, something easy to grab and a little bit different offering than what other Japanese restaurants are doing.
As David described earlier, they took great pains to make sure their business would fit into the neighborhood by consulting with the neighborhood association and the previous business owner. Here's David again talking about why that is important.
It's about, to me, it's about the idea of the uniqueness of Chinatown in Montreal, and how any other district can you know, start to look alike if the urban planning laws permit it. You know, the developers will do what they can to maximize the terrain, and you know, Chinatown has been kind of coveted and maybe a little bit more guarded, and has preserved its architecture, has a lot of old buildings, has the beautiful gates. It's got a feeling that you don't get anywhere else in the city. And, you know, it would be a shame to turn it into any other district by not preserving it. You know, if this building became a Starbucks, it wouldn't have the same sheen as it does right now. And the signage would be different, and it just wouldn't have that charm that it does right now. So to me, it's kind of an obvious, you know, good choice to do. And I think that's how you fit well into a neighborhood, is by dialoguing with the rest of the neighborhood and fitting well into the idea of the neighborhood, you know.
If Chinatown were to change too much or even disappear, there would be so much that would be lost. Here's Edmund again talking about the diversity of food you can't find anywhere else besides Chinatown.
Like outside of Chinatown, I don't think you can find like kind of all-in-one kind of things that are in Chinatown. Like if you want to get like Chinese groceries, obviously there are other Chinese grocery stores, but you have to go there. But you won't have like dim sum right beside it, or you won't have like our style, like Chinese style barbecue beside it, or anything like that. You have like the all-in-one like Asians. You have like you have like your pho, your Vietnamese noodles if you want to get them. You can have your yes, sushi. You can have the ramen noodles. You can do you can still do the dragon beard. I think still does that. Dragon beard still there. You have the the fried chicken place is pretty good too. The cock. You just have the all-in-one like Asian stuff.
Food is, of course, a huge part of Chinatown's cultural heritage. But Fei pointed out that the threats to Chinatown also risk the loss of community and mutual aid.
Just because there are so many services that are provided for Asian communities and also non-Asian communities who need help and, you know, who are just immigrants and aren't familiar with Montreal. There are mental health professionals, there are physical health professionals, there are, you know, like chiropractors, there are, you know, there's food, obviously, and, you know, it's just a place where you can get everything you need as an immigrant and not feel alienated. And it's really important that when you're an immigrant that you feel comfortable. It would definitely be a great loss for Asian communities and also immigrant communities for there not to be a Chinatown, for Chinatown to reduce in its ability to provide these services. I think one of the reasons why so many immigrants move to big cities like Montreal is because there is a place like Chinatown that they can go to for help.
And David underlined that there is a history of architecture in the neighborhood that can't be replicated anywhere else.
If I use our building as an example, this building, you know, there's deeds of sale all the way back to 1847. It's a very old building. We can trace it back to a certain date, but we don't know exactly what date it's from. Some cities are barely that old. You know, you don't see necessarily a lot of these buildings in Toronto or Vancouver, let's say. I think we have a duty to uphold the history of this city that's been around for a long time and has had an immense impact on the evolution of Canada in general. And I think Chinatown is an intrinsic part of that history and of the history of our city. And if it isn't preserved, it's very well positioned, close to downtown or in downtown, to become another part of downtown. And downtown is useful and beautiful in its own right, and is kind of an emblem of commercial behavior in this city. But Chinatown has a strong cultural vibe that won't be replicated in the future somewhere else.
Chinatown has proven use, beauty, and significance for so many people and is a part of the fabric of Montreal. And if it is going to continue, it needs to have the space to acknowledge its history so it can evolve in a way that still serves all the communities it has always meant all these things to.
Me, I often differ situation, many situation with a music experience because I'm a big fan of collecting vinyl music and then playing it. So me preserving this place is like vinyl music itself, and you kind of need, you know, new stuff, but you need old things that people have made in the past. And I feel like if everything is same, everything is new, then there's no harmony. Very beautiful music melody comes from different keys. So I feel that we need differences in our life, diversity in our life, but important thing is people appreciate the difference and learn something from it, feel, you know, the appreciation from what people have left us.
Thank you for listening to The Squeaky Curd. Today's episode wouldn't have been possible without the participation of Charles Hsu, Fei Sun, Edmund Koo, Queenie C, Hideyuki Imizumi, and David Schmidt. You can learn more about the Chinatown Working Group by visiting their Facebook page, and there will be a link to the petition to grant Montreal's Chinatown historic landmark status on the Squeaky Curds link tree. The Concordia Student Union just wrapped up a ton of events for Asian Heritage Month, but you can still follow them online at csu.qc.ca and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as the Concordia Canadian Asian Society for further resources. You can check out Queenie's family's business, Teen Teen Magazine, at 1008 Clark Street under Ruby Rouge Restaurant. And what do you know it? It's May 28th, so that means restaurants are open for outdoor in-person dining for the first time since September of last year. Dobie and Andy won't be open in a terrace, but will still be continuing takeout and delivery service from their location in the Place de Cartier building at the corner of René Lévesque and Saint Urban. Fleur et Cadeau will be opening a small patio at their location at 1002 Saint Urban. These are not the only Chinatown or Montreal restaurants that need support right now, so please go out and eat or keep ordering that takeout. Our show illustration and logo were designed by Christina Rivera. This is the last episode of The Squeaky Curd before we go on a summer hiatus. From Gwen Rowley, you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Oh, bye. Just take a-